Good morning, everyone. For the eagle-eyed amongst you, you'll notice we're not continuing with Corinthians this Sunday. No prizes for spotting that. This was sold to me as a freebie, just for everyone's information. I really struggle when someone says, preach from whatever you feel led to preach on. I'm much more comfortable being told what to do. Jen and my mother may disagree with that statement, but on the whole, especially when it comes to preaching, it is true. This weekend, the nation has been celebrating. We obviously have an extra bank holiday. That's always worth celebrating. I should be standing here celebrating the first victory of the season for Eastleigh cricket team. But both the weather and lack of people combined to make sure that didn't happen. But of course, many of us have been celebrating the coronation of King Charles III. And for many of us, this will have been the first coronation we have witnessed or remembered. You would have to be significantly over 70, and I will not ask for a show of hands. As to whether you do remember the previous coronation of Queen Elizabeth II. It got me thinking about 70 years is quite a long time to wait for something to happen. Lots of things will have changed in those 70 years. And in fact, many people who spoke about the late Queen spoke of her ability to adapt to all the changes that she saw throughout her lifetime. I went and looked back at how things might have been different in 1953. For example, in 1953, in the United Kingdom, the average house price was £1,891. Imagine being able to buy a house for less than £2,000. You'd have to go to Doncaster or somewhere like that for such a bargain. And I have one if anyone would like to buy one. For about that price, that would be good. A brand new family car was somewhere between £500 and £600. A loaf of bread cost something that I don't understand, 7.5D. I assume the D stands for Deutschmark, maybe, in honour of our royal family's heritage. Maybe not, no? Okay, too soon. Mr. Average took home a weekly pay of £7, something the Tories would like to. So lots and lots of things have changed. But in many ways, some things haven't. Mrs. Average, for example, took home 30% less than Mr. Average. Some things change, some things don't. And as the build-up to the big day came, I started to think about how much change happens. And then I started to think, I wonder how much difference having a coronation will make. Will life be different once King Charles III has been crowned? Will life for the ordinary person on the street change at all because there's a new person on the throne? I don't want to downplay the importance of national celebration, of times when we can come together and enjoy what is going on. But once the bunting is down and the flags are packed away and Annie needs to find a new excuse to wear her Union Jack dress, what will have changed for people? How will life be different for anyone in this country? One particular aspect of the coronation dominated the build-up. The Archbishop of Canterbury announced that we as the public would have a chance to stand and make our own personal and public vow of allegiance to King Charles III. It caused quite a stir on social media in particular. And especially for Christians, as many battled with the idea of vowing allegiance to anyone other than Jesus. The more irate other people got about it, the less I realized I didn't care either way. Because again, I came back to the conclusion, what difference would it make to stand and publicly pledge allegiance to Charles? Will that change our lives? Will that change who we are? Will that change what we do? And amidst all the sort of maudlin party pooper atmosphere I was trying to bring to the nation yesterday, it did get me thinking about why. Why do we have kings and queens in the first place? Why are nations so desperate to have a figurehead to lead them? Why, as human beings, throughout history, have we wanted someone to be in charge? As the furore went on and on about making a pledge of allegiance to King Charles, it made me think about us as Christians. Most Sundays we gather, and in one form or another, through word or song or prayer, we make a pledge of allegiance. We may not use those words, but we give ourselves and our lives to Jesus. And I thought, what difference should that make to who we are and what we do? Why do we, as Christians, need, want and hope for this King of Kings? Throughout the Old Testament, we catch sight of why people want a king. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, we have this story of the people of Israel. They go to the prophet Samuel and say, "We want a king." And Samuel says, "No, you don't." And the people say, "Yes, we do." And it goes on for quite a while. The first pantomime, I think, in history. And Samuel says, "You don't want a king. You already have one Lord, one sovereign. He is God." But the people go, "No, we really want a king. We want to be like the other nations. We want someone who will lead us in battle. We want someone who will take control, who will fix things." And I think that is true for all history. We want strong, charismatic leaders who will come in and fix things, sort things, lead us forward into a bright new future. It's not a political statement to say that the last general election was won on the back of three words: "Get Brexit done." And the nation voted for that simple slogan. We like charismatic leaders who will stand in front of us and promise to sort things out, promise to get stuff done and lead us forward into our bright new future. Things haven't changed in the thousands of years of human civilization. By the time we get to Zechariah in the Old Testament, the prophets are starting to speak a little differently. They're starting to speak of a king who will come, who will be different from the other kings we have experienced, who are different from the kings that the people will want. And Israel, at the time, needed someone. For those who don't know the context of Zechariah, it was written in 520 BC. We know that quite specifically, which is nice. It was written about 10 years after Israel had returned home from 70 years in exile. It was meant to be a great and glorious return, one of joy and triumph, one where God would be center, where life would return to normal. But unfortunately for Israel, that never quite happened. They only returned from exile at the pleasure of the Persian Empire. They were this puppet state, only existing due to that empire allowing it to. And Zechariah brings this prophecy that whilst life might not be as we wanted it to be, whilst life may not have returned to how we hoped it would, there is a king on the way. And in one sense, Zechariah is playing into that narrative of we like kings who get stuff done. We like kings who will come and fix things and lead us and defeat our enemies. But in other ways, Zechariah speaks of a king who is very different. There are many differences between the king in Zechariah and the kings of the times gone by. But there are two huge ones which mirror the sort of king we see in Jesus. The first one is that this king in Zechariah is not looking to destroy. This king is not looking to win at all costs. On the surface, that might not seem to be the case. After all, Zechariah uses a lot of war-like imagery in his prophecy. But if we take time to read the actual words, we will see that Zechariah is not talking about blood and thunder and vengeance. The armies of the ancient world, Israel included, would have had war horses and chariots. They would have had strong, mighty soldiers. They would have been led by a king on the most fearsome of steeds, surrounded by the mightiest of men. This king, however, will come to you riding on a donkey, but not just any donkey. This donkey's special, because this donkey is a baby donkey. So that will strike fear into your enemies, no doubt. This is a king who will get rid of war horses and chariots. But note, it's not the enemy's war horses and chariots. It's Israel's. He will lay down arms. He will abandon the army. This will not be a king who leads by military might or force. And yet somehow this is a king who will bring peace to the nations. It is a direct contrast with the kings of days gone by. Israel wanted a king, so they had someone to lead them in battle, someone who would win the war, defeat the enemies. They sang songs of their kings who had slain thousands and tens of thousands. Peace was something you only gained when your army was bigger than your opponent's army. Peace was the cost of slaying hundreds and thousands of people. But here was a king who would get rid of the army and yet maintain peace. And even when there is a word about the enemy is Greece. For those who know your New Testament well, this is not a common enemy of Israel. Greece and Israel did not meet too often on the battlefield. In 520 BC, Greece was a growing power in the Mediterranean, but had no interest in looking further east towards Assyria, Babylon, and Persia. What Greece was, though, was a growing hubbub of philosophy, science, and democracy. Now, I'm not trying to be anti-democratic or anti-scientific, but what Zechariah is getting at here is that people are moving from putting their trust in kings and monarchy to putting their trust in systems and logic. And the challenge for us as Christians, and as the challenge was for the faithful Jewish communities all those years ago, was to whom do we look for our safety? To whom do we look for our security? When we stand and sing, "I will trust in you alone," is that something we stand and say because the Archbishop of Canterbury has asked us to stand and say it? Or is it a true pledge that the one we will trust is God and God alone? In short, what Zechariah is saying is that here is a king who is like no other king, who will forge a path that you did not even think was possible, who will break the bow, get rid of the war horses, and still bring peace. How will this happen is probably the second huge difference between this king and ones gone past. For this will be a king who will not impose upon us what we are meant to do. This is not a king who will point a sword at us and say, "Do this or die." This is a king who will invite us to participate in life. This will be a king who asks us not to slavishly obey, but to choose to obey. To choose to want a world in which peace, justice, and hope will reign. This king has come to liberate. And at the risk of being lynched, good time to pause. The reality is, wherever you have a monarchy, you have an unequal society. That is not meant to be controversial. It is fact. If you're going to have an elite group of people who own a huge chunk of the wealth of a nation, you have established an unequal situation. It was only 150 years ago that the aristocracy owned 60% of all the land in this country. And of the other 40%, the Church of England owned pretty much the rest of it. We may have moved on from such times, and we, of course, have now the wonderful constitutional monarchy as opposed to the absolute monarchy. I'm sure Hannah can give us a lecture in the history of that some other time. But the reality is, wherever there is a monarchy, there is an imbalance of power. If you read through the Old Testament, you will see that the kings of Israel and Judah were no better than the medieval kings we know so well from history lessons. Kings who believed their subjects were there at their pleasure. They lived or died at the whim of a king. Israel did not fare much better with those chosen to rule over them. But this king is different. This king has come to free people, not enslave them. Simply by putting the army to one side, this king has given people something they have not had before. Choice. There's not much choice if there's a sword at your throat. But this king will lead differently. This king will seal their authority and position, not with the blood of the soldiers sent into battle, but with his own blood as he makes a covenant with the people. This king will not imprison those who disagree. He will release the prisoners. This king will not deprive people of what they need in a waterless pit. Instead, he will return them, in Zechariah's wonderful words, to a fortress of hope. This king will not have subjects. This king will have sons and daughters, roused up, as Zechariah says, to trust in God alone. It is little wonder that the gospel writers saw the parallels with Jesus in this passage. And they, all four of them, allude to this passage in one way or another when writing about Jesus. They saw the fulfillment of such a king in one person only, and his name is Jesus. The one who would bring life and not death. The one who would bring peace and not a sword. One who would bring freedom through his own blood, not the blood of others. A king who doesn't impose upon us an agenda, but invites us to be participants, active players in establishing a kingdom of justice, mercy, and hope. As Christians, we find ourselves in the strange position of both acknowledging Jesus as Lord and Savior, and also realizing that Jesus has asked us to play our part in building this kingdom. None of this means that we should not pray for King Charles III, as Toby has already said. We should pray that he would be someone who would exhibit such things in his life through his example and his words. Neither does it mean that we can simply abandon our civic duties. For the prophets also tell us to seek the peace and prosperity of the land to which we have been carried. For this is where the Old Testament prophets land. Yes, they speak of a future. They speak of a king who will come, who will transform and redeem, a king who will save and liberate, a king who will not have subjects but sons and daughters. But they are also very clear that the people of Israel have a part to play. To love justice, to seek mercy, to walk humbly. To not put their trust in rituals and pageantry, but to put their trust in the one true King. This weekend, we were invited to make a public pledge of allegiance to King Charles III. And I'm not going to ask whether anyone did or didn't. Honestly, I'm not sure it matters one jot. But I think it is a good time to inwardly reflect on those words we often offer to Jesus, those words we say and pray and sing aloud, and to reflect on whether these are words we say because they're on a screen behind us, or whether it is the overflow of a heart that truly acknowledges the one true King. Interestingly, a King who does not ask us for words tells us to not make oaths, tells us not to stand and babble on. Instead, Jesus asks us for something far greater and more costly than that. He asks for our very lives to reflect the King of Kings. I'm glad we have a coronation weekend and not just for a bank holiday. I'm glad we have the opportunity to gather together and celebrate. Life is enriched by such times, and we do not need to justify the need to get together and enjoy one another's company and come together as a nation to celebrate. I am glad that as Christians, it gives us the opportunity to reflect on what true kingship looks like. I also hope this weekend gives us an opportunity to reflect on all those words we have offered to Jesus over our lives, and to ask, what difference does it make? We have celebrated King Charles III. As a church family, we gather together to lift up, to acknowledge, and to use the words of the weekend to pledge our allegiance to the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, whose name is Jesus. Amen.